Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. The following talk is by Richard Sternberg, a biologist with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Sternberg will be discussing evidence that refutes the myth that the human genome is full of junk DNA. This lecture was recorded at a recent Science and Human Origins conference. Here's Dr. Sternberg.
ID the Future's gift to you. What a pleasure to settle into a holiday with a good book to read. Better than one book, of course, is two. Or how about 12 new books or DVDs? Starting on Black Friday, we'll have 12 days of discounts on Intelligent Design and Evolution resources, with a new item specially discounted each day. Be sure to check evolutionnews.org for each day's item. That's 12 days of discounts at evolutionnews.org. Now back to ID the Future.
And here's another thing I want to focus on in my last few minutes. 2005, I co-authored a series of papers with the geneticist who first isolated at the molecular level one of these jumping genes, James Shapiro. And we compiled all the evidence of functionality that we could find, and I'd been doing that since the 1980s, of these so-called junk sequences. And we analyzed the data, and we came to the conclusion that if you want to think of how DNA is organized, you have to think of it as being, if you will, a read-write medium. And it's organized in such a way that an operating system can use that read-write medium in an intelligible way. And he, by the way, is no sympathizer with intelligent design, but neither is he a Darwinian. And what we anticipated is that this thing called a gene, the focus, the basis of neo-Darwinism, is likely to be something akin to a subroutine of an operating system, and therefore nothing you're going to be able to pinpoint with a pair of tweezers and say, aha, I got it. I got that subroutine. That would make no sense. And in 2007, the first results of the ENCODE project came out. How many of you have ever heard of ENCODE? Well, here's the thing. When I started at the NIH, Craig Venter, on one hand, Francis Collins, on the other, they had just around the same time completed the first drafts of the human DNA sequence, which was Craig Venter's DNA sequence. And the idea was, it was sold to Congress this way, is that once we have those miles and miles of code in hand, we're going to be able to, and I am quoting, compute the human being. So 2001, champagne glasses are being clinked. But then you've got all of these grunts sitting in front of their computers, PhDs, but they're sitting there just, you know, out there, and you're looking at these miles and miles of data, and no one had a clue what it meant, how to read the data. So they decided to set about this project and look at how the DNA is being actually used in real time. And that's where the ENCODE comes. And they were doing the same thing with the fruit fly and with the roundworm. It's called MOD ENCODE. They looked at mice, they looked at humans, and in 2007, a flurry of papers came out. And the shocking thing about ENCODE was that they concluded that, first of all, most of the activity is taking place in the junk DNA. Second is that even though 1.5% roughly codes for protein, all of it appears to be at some point in time transcribed. And a lot of it, after it's transcribed, is so edited, it no longer mirrors the underlying DNA sequence it came from. But the third thing, and this was a shocking thing, is they said, we have no clue what a gene is. It doesn't appear to have a physical boundary. You can have a marker, you'll pick a piece of chromosome, and remember I showed you all those overlapping lines? They'll say, well, there's an RNA here, and an RNA there, and an RNA here, and an RNA there, and they're all over the place. And every month goes by and we're discovering new classes of them. So this raised the question. They said, what is this thing called a gene? Here's another example. Here's an attempt to define a gene. And this shows you an example where they're saying you've got this real problem. The problem is it's a relation that's on the one hand one to many, and on the other hand, many to one. So there's nothing linear about it. It's very complicated. Now, what does a new gene definition imply? Well, now the second ENCODE results came out late 2012. It was a flurry of papers, about 34 of them that came out at the same time, and there was a reason they did so. It's a multinational consortium. So it's a Cecil B. DeMille production, a cast of thousands. It's not just one guy sitting there and coming up with this. It's like reading a physics cyclotron paper. You look at the authors, and it starts, it's just on and on and on. And so you just use CERN consortium. But here it's called the landscape of RNA production in human cells. And there's a very interesting line in there. They came to the conclusion that given all their data, the gene would then denote a higher order concept intended to capture all those RNAs, but eventually divorced from their genomic locations, meaning DNA could be put over to the side. Here's another person who put an even more interesting point on it. It says, on this view, and this is one of the main organizers of ENCODE, said genes represent a higher order framework around which individual RNAs coalesce, creating a polyfunctional entity that assumes different forms under different cellular states. Now, which group do you think was the first to say this cannot stand? Which group said, shut the project down? Who? Absolutely. In fact, one of them, Dan Grauer, is the most vocal. He said, if these results are true, there can be no evolution. Here's why. What most people do not realize is that the gene concept was generated. It's a construct. It was constructed by the new synthesis proponents in the 1920s and 1930s. The idea was the gene would be a discrete physical particle. It would be mutable. All the information would be there. Since you could change it and it's strictly physical, right? Then selection would come. Now here's a problem. So you open a population or evolutionary genetics textbook and you deal with small A's and big A's and small B's and big B's and how they're shifted in the population, right? Very simple. Anyone can understand it. And so you get this illusion that, oh, I could see how if it's a particle, it could evolve over time through the particle changing. So I raise this question. How in the world do you evolve a higher order polyfunctional entity that assumes different forms at different states at different times, etc.? How do you deal with that? Now you say, well, this is very interesting because the fact is we have no mathematical framework for addressing that sort of thing. Genetics just transitioned into the same period that physics transitioned into around 1910 and 1920, where you had the idea, who was it, Lord Kelvin, who said basically we know all there is to know, 1900, we need to put a few numbers behind the decimal point, but science is over. And then, of course, you have, you know, we've got a lot of anomalous data. And then you have other people coming around, and I am wrapping up here, John. You have other people coming around, and they're saying, like Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger and Max Planck, et cetera, and they're saying, guess what? In order to explain a particle, you need what? You need an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. The thing is, the particle is existing in all these states all at once. When you physically measure it, you see one. But the fact is, you're only getting a glimpse of what that particle really is. And in order to explain it, you have to use what? Quantum mechanics. And as Feynman said, if anyone tells you they know what quantum mechanics is, they're lying to you. They can do the math, but it works out, but you can't get your mind around it. We transitioned in the same period with the gene. And the man who anticipated that, there were several who anticipated it. And I'm going to skip forward here. I want to finish my point, and then I'll come back to that because I brought this to you. This state of affairs was anticipated by the very man who coined the term gene and genotype and phenotype. That was Wilhelm Johannson. Wilhelm Johannson believed that the gene was a field. But so did Richard Goldschmidt, who was the arch-heretic of heretics, who broke from Neo-Darwinism, one of the leading European. He said, no, it's got to be a field. So did William Bateson, one of the leading geneticists. And also interesting is that the one who in 1944 it's a book called What is Life? He was a theoretical physicist, and I mentioned him, Erwin Schrödinger. And he described, he said, well, the thing is, in order for a gene to be what a gene is, it's got to be a very strange entity. It's got to be formal cause, this higher order concept, Aristotelian, it's got to have a form. It's got to embody final cause. It's got to have a telos. There's got to be something pulling it, so to speak, as well as being a material entity and as well as embracing efficient cause. He said you got to have the whole shebang. Otherwise, the gene isn't. And in fact, you had other people around the same time when they said, what is the gene? Dean and Hinshelwood, two authors in a book where they're discussing biochemistry, they said basically it's got to be a mystical entity. So the point is, Johansson and others thought about this. They said, but if that's true, then you could no more talk about evolution of particles than you could in physics, theoretical physics, talk about, say, the evolution of the Rutherford atom. It simply would make no sense. You got to have another framework. And the one who put the fine point on this was that because of the backlash, this is the final thing I'm going to say, because of the backlash of ENCODE, because of all these results that frankly are irreconcilable with the standard boilerplate scenario that we are supposed to imbibe, because of the backlash, ENCODE should be cut down. And that's what they're asking for. That's what they were asking for. They said it was big science run amok, that the consensus is wrong. Year before, they're saying, no, big science is big science, and you got to stick with the consensus. And then suddenly the consensus says, no, here we are. We're the consensus. And they're like, wait a second. We don't like this consensus. So in response to it, Philip Ball of Nature, he basically lays it out, and he says, guess what? For 60 years, actually longer than that, the whole notion of what a gene is has been hotly debated. He says, we do not know what most of our DNA does, nor how or to what extent it governs traits, such as the color of your eyes, how tall you are, your likes and your dislikes, etc. And he said, in other words, we do not fully understand how evolution works at the molecular level. And then he says, this sounds like an extraordinary state of affairs. And what he then goes on to say is that, but if you're a member of the public, you'll never hear about this. No one talks about it because they don't want it talked about. And so, ladies and gentlemen, if I've done one thing, is I've told you about it. You now know it. It's fascinating. But the point is that if we do not know what a gene is, if we cannot identify a gene with DNA, then frankly, the 1%, 10%, all the differences you can line up are really kind of neither here nor there. There's something else occurring at a higher level that is making a difference. And we've got glimpses of it from some of the things that I've showed you. But the problem is that if you do not have a coherent notion of a gene, and if you do not have a gene notion that fits with that of evolutionary genetics, then in my opinion, the field is defunct. It's akin to, and I'm not exaggerating, but it's akin to if you were studying phlogiston or ether. I mean, you could get a lot of interesting data. The medieval alchemists came up with some interesting data when they were not engaged in spiritualistic excesses. But the point is, you can get a lot of data. Your theory can be completely wrong, but you get a lot of facts. But nevertheless, the point comes in, you don't have departments studying phlogiston anymore. And it's very similar to this. All of our hopes, if you are a Darwinian, are pinned on the gene being DNA and that DNA being mutable and everything going there. And you break that bond, and then all these other issues suddenly become adrift. And we're right back at square one. And I'm going to close there.
This lecture was recorded at a Science and Human Origins conference in the fall of 2014. The conference featured John West, Casey Luskin, Anne Gager, and Rick Sternberg talking about the fossil, genetic, and social issues surrounding the debate over human origins. We will be featuring these speakers on future episodes of ID the Future. For more information, please visit idthefuture.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.